on their residents a different sense of self than did the homes couched among cow pastures and tobacco fields. The towny shine would have dimmed quickly, I now realize, if the merchant's confident offspring were catapulted suddenly into Philadelphia or Louisville. Urban is relative. But the bottom line is that it matters. The antipathy in our culture between the urban and non-urban is so durable, it has its own vocabulary. A. City slicker, tenderfoot. B. Hick, redneck, hayseed, bumpkin, rube, yokel, clodhopper, hoecake, hillbilly, dogpatch, Daisy May, farmer's daughter, from the provinces, something out of Deliverance. Maybe you see where I'm going with this. The list is lopsided. I don't think there's much doubt on either side as to which class is winning the culture wars. Most rural people of my acquaintance would not gladly give up their status. Like other minorities, we've managed to turn several of the aforementioned slurs into celebrated cultural identifiers for use by insiders only. In my own life, I've had ample opportunity to reinvent myself as a city person, to pass, as it were, but I've remained tacitly rural identified in my psyche, even while living in some of the world's major cities. It's probably this dual citizenship that has sensitized me to my nation's urban-rural antipathy and how it affects people in both camps. Rural concerns are less covered by the mainstream media and often considered intrinsically comic. Corruption in city governments is reported as grim news everywhere. From small towns or Tennessee, it is fodder for talk show jokes. Thomas Hardy wrote about the sort of people who milked cows, but writers who do so in the modern era will be dismissed as marginal. The policy of our nation is made in cities, controlled largely by urban voters who aren't well informed about the changes on the face of our land and the men and women who work it. Those changes can be mapped on worry lines. As the years have gone by, as farms have gone out of business, America has given an ever smaller cut of each food dollar, now less than 19%, to its farmers. The psychic divide between rural and urban people is surely a part of the problem. Wendell Berry writes, "Eaters must understand that eating takes place inescapably in the world, that it is inescapably an agricultural act, and that how we eat determines, to a considerable extent, how the world is used. Eaters must," he claims, "but it sure looks like most eaters don't. If they did, how would we frame the sentence suggested by today's food-buying habits directed toward today's farmers? 'Let them eat dirt' is hardly overstating it. The urban U.S. middle class appears more specifically concerned about exploited Asian factory workers. Symptomatic of this rural-urban identity crisis is our eager embrace of a recently imposed divide, the red states and the blue states. That color map comes to us with the suggestion that both coasts are populated by educated civil libertarians, while the vast middle and south are crisscrossed with the studded tracks of ATVs leaving a trail of flying beer cans and rebel yells. Okay, I'm exaggerating a little, but I certainly sense a bit of that when urban friends ask me how I can stand living here so far from everything. When I hear this question over the phone, I'm usually looking out the window at a forest, a running creek, and a vegetable garden, thinking, define everything. Otherwise sensitive coastal-dwelling folk may refer to the whole chunk of our continent lying between the Cascades and the Hudson River as the interior. I gather this is now a common designation. It's hard for me to see the usefulness of lumping Minneapolis, Atlanta, my little hometown in Kentucky, Yellowstone Park, and so forth, into a single category that does not include New York and California. going into the interior sounds like an endeavor that might require machetes to hack through the tangled vines. In fact, the politics of rural regions are no more predictable than those in cities. Conservative is a reasonable position for a farmer who can lose home and livelihood all in one year by taking a risk on a new crop. But that's conservative as in eager to conserve what we have, reluctant to change the rules overnight, and unrelated to how the term is currently and often incomprehensibly applied in party politics. The farm county where I grew up had so few Republicans, they all registered Democrat so they could vote in the only local primary. My earliest understanding of radical, class-conscious politics came from miners' strikes in one of the most rural parts of my state and of our nation. The only useful generalization I'd hazard about rural politics is that they tend to break on the line of insider versus outsider. When my country neighbors sit down with a new social group, the first question they ask one another is not, what do you do, but rather, who are your people? Commonly, we will spend more than the first 10 minutes of a new acquaintance tracing how our families might be related, if not by blood, then by marriage. Failing that, by identifying someone significant we have known in common. Only after this ritual of familial placing does the conversation comfortably move on to other subjects. I am blessed with an ancestor who was the physician in this county from about 1910 into the 1940s. From older people, I'll often hear of some memorably dire birth or farm accident to which my great-uncle was called. Lucky for me, he was skilled and Hippocratic. But even a criminal ancestor will get you insider status among the forgiving. Not so lucky are those who move here with no identifiable family ties. Such a dark horse is likely to remain the new fellow for the rest of his natural life, even if he arrived in his prime and lives to be 100. The country tradition of mistrusting outsiders may be unfairly applied, but it's not hard to understand. For much of U.S. history, rural regions have been treated essentially as colonial property of the cities. The carpetbaggers of the Reconstruction era were not the first or the last opportunists to capitalize on an extractive economy. When urban-headquartered companies come to the country with a big plan, whether their game is coal, timber, or industrial agriculture, the plan is to take out the good stuff, ship it to the population centers, make a fortune, and leave behind a mess. Given this history, one might expect the so-called red states to vote consistently for candidates supporting working-class values. In fact, our nation in almost every region is divided in a near-dead heat between two parties that apparently don't distinguish themselves clearly along class lines. If every state were visually represented with the exact blend of red and blue it earned in recent elections, we'd have ourselves a big purple country. The tidy divide is a media just-so story. Our uneasy relationship between heartland and coasts, farm and factory, country and town, is certainly real. But it is both more rudimentary and more subtle than most political analysts make it out to be. It's about loyalties, perceived communities, and the things each side understands to be important because of the ground, literally, upon which we stand. Wendell Berry summed it up much better than blue and red in one line of dialogue from his novel Jaber Crow, which is peopled by farmers struggling to survive on what the modern, mostly urban market will pay for food. After watching nearly all the farms in the county go bankrupt, one of these men comments, "I've wished sometimes that the sons of bitches would starve, and now I'm getting afraid they actually will."
Sustaining the Unsustainable by Stephen Hoff. Doesn't the federal farm bill help out all these poor farmers? No. It used to, but ever since its inception, just after the Depression, the federal farm bill has slowly been altered by agribusiness lobbyists. It is now largely corporate welfare. The formula for subsidies is based on crop type and volume. From 1995 to 2003, 3/4 of all disbursements went to the top grossing 10% of growers. In 1999, over 70% of subsidies went for just two commodity crops, corn and soybeans. These supports promote industrial-scale production, not small diversified farms, and in fact create an environment of competition in which subsidized commodity producers get help crowding the little guys out of business. It is this, rather than any improved efficiency or productiveness, that has allowed corporations to take over farming in the United States, leaving fewer than 1/3 of our farms still run by families. But those family-owned farms are the ones more likely to use sustainable techniques, protect the surrounding environment, maintain green spaces, use crop rotations and management for pest and weed controls, and apply fewer chemicals. In other words, they're doing exactly what 80% of United States consumers say we would prefer to support, while our tax dollars do the opposite. Because of significant protest about this lack of support, Congress included a tiny allotment for local foods in the most recent 2002 Farm Bill. Some support for farmers markets, community food projects, and local foods in schools. But the total of all these programs combined is less than 0.5% of the Farm Bill budget, and none of it is for the food itself, only the advertising and administration of these programs. Consumers who care about food, health, and the supply of cheap calories drowning our school lunch programs, for example, might want to let their representatives know we're looking for a dramatically restructured Farm Bill. Until then, support for local and sustainable agriculture will have to come directly from motivated customers. For more information, visit farmaid.org. That's FARMAID.org.
In high summer, about the time I was seeing red in my kitchen, the same thing was happening to some of our county's tomato farmers. They had learned organic methods, put away the chemicals, and done everything right to grow a product consumers claimed to want. They'd waited the 3 years for certification. They'd watered, weeded, and picked. They'd sorted the round from the misshapen, producing the perfect organic tomatoes ordered by grocery chains. And then, suddenly, when the farmers were finally bringing in these tomatoes by the truckload and hoping for a decent payout, some grocery buyers backtracked. "Not this week," one store offered without warning, and then another. "Not the next week, either, nor the next." A tomato is not a thing that can be put on hold. Mountains of ripe fruits piled up behind the packing house and turned to orange sludge, swarming with clouds of fruit flies. These tomatoes were perfect, and buyers were hungry. Agreements had been made, but pallets of organic tomatoes from California had begun coming in just a few dollars cheaper. It's hard to believe, given the amount of truck fuel involved. But transportation is tax-deductible for the corporations, so we taxpayers paid for that shipping. The California growers only needed the economics of scale on their side, a cheap army of pickers, and customers who would reliably opt for the lower price. As simply as that, a year of planning and family labor turned to red mush. Our growers had been warned that this could happen. Market buyers generally don't sign a binding contract. So the farmers took a risk and took a loss. Some of them will try again next year, though they will likely hedge their bets with delicata squash and peas as well. Courage, practicality, and making the best of a bad situation are much of what farming is about. Before the tomatoes all rotted away, Appalachian Harvest found a way to donate and distribute the enormous excess of unpurchased produce to needy families. The poor of our county were rich in tomatoes that summer. "We were glad we could give it away," one of the farmers told me. "We like to be generous and help others. That's fine. That's who we are. But a lot of us are barely making ends meet ourselves. It seems like it's always the people that have the least who end up giving the most. Why is that?" In Charlottesville, Asheville, Roanoke, and Knoxville, supermarket shoppers had no way of knowing how much heartache and betrayal might be wrapped up in those cellophane 2-packs of California tomatoes. Maybe they noticed the other tomatoes were missing this week, those local ones with the Healthy Farms Close to Home label. Or maybe they just saw organic tomatoes, picked them up, and dropped them into their carts on top of the cereal boxes and paper towels. Eaters must understand how we eat determines how the world is used. They will or they won't, and the happy grocery store music plays on.
Canning Season by Camille. When I was a kid, summer was as long as a lifetime. A month could pass without me ever knowing what day of the week it was. Time seemed to stretch into one gigantic, lazy day of blackberry picking and crawdad hunting. My friends and I would pretty much spend our lives together, migrating back and forth between the town swimming pool and the woods, where we would pretend to be orphans left to our own devices in the wilderness. School was not on our minds. Our world was green grass, sunshine, and imagination. Then August would roll around, a tragedy every time. Already? How can this be? I would ask, shattered by the terrible truth that I needed a 3-ring binder and some number 2 pencils. It's not that school was a bad thing. Summer was just so much better. August is rarely announced to kids by a calendar. For some of my friends, it was the shiny floors and fluorescent lights of the department stores with their back-to-school sales that brought the message. For me, it was the bubbling canning bath and the smell of tomatoes. In my family, the end of summer means the drone of our food dehydrator is background music, and you can't open the fridge without huge, lumpy bags of produce falling out and clobbering your feet. Every spare half hour goes into cutting up something to be preserved, the beans and corn to be blanched and frozen, the cucumbers sliced and pickled, the squash frozen or dehydrated, or pawned off on a friend. And then there are the tomatoes. Pounds of them roll down from the garden each day, staining every one of our kitchen towels with their crimson juices. We slice little ones by the hundred and lay them out on the stackable trays of our food dryer. We can the medium-sized ones, listening afterwards for each ping that tells us the jar lid has properly sealed. The rest go into big, bubbling pots of tomato sauce. I'm sure this sounds like a hassle and a mess to those who have never done it, but for us, it's an important part of the summer. Not only because the outcome is great meals for the rest of the year, but because the process is our way of saying goodbye to the sunshine and pace of summer and reflecting on what the season gave us. August's busy kitchen is our transition from the long, open-ended hours of summer outdoor work to the stricter routines of school and work in the fall. I like to think of it as an end-of-summer meditation. American culture doesn't allow much room for slow reflection. I watch the working people who are supposed to be my role models getting pushed to go, 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 and take as little vacation time as possible. And then, often, vacations are full of endless activity, too, so you might come back from your break feeling exhausted. Canning tomato sauce isn't exactly a week at the spa, but it definitely forces a pause in the multitasking whirl of everyday life. It's a slow down and do one thing at a time process. Now chop vegetables, now stir them until the sauce thickens, now sterilize the jars, make sure each ring is tight. If you're going to do anything else at the same time, it had better just be listening to your own thoughts. Anything else could cause you to blow the entire batch. Canning always puts me in a kind of trance, I reach a point where stirring the bubbling sauce is the world's only task, and I could do it forever. Whether you prefer to sit on a rock in a peaceful place or take a wooden spoon to a simmering pot, it does the body good to quiet down and tune in. The basic canning process is as simple as this. First, tomatoes are dropped into boiling water and peeled, or else cooked down with other ingredients into sauce. Second, they are poured into sterilized mason jars, we take them straight from the dishwasher, and capped with two-part screw-on lids. And third, the filled jars are boiled for the number of minutes specified by the recipe in a big pot of water. We use an enamelware canning kettle that handles 10 quarts at a time. On the website are some of my personal favorite recipes for canning, including Frijoli Moli, Family Secret Tomato Sauce, and the Relish Sauce and Chutney All-in-One Day recipe. The family secret in our tomato sauce, which obviously won't be now, is cinnamon and nutmeg, usually thought of as dessert spices, but used in savory tomato dishes in Greek and some Middle Eastern cuisines. The three-sauce recipe is adapted from The Busy Person's Guide to Preserving Food by Janet Chadwick. Our green bean holy moly was inspired by Recipes from a Kitchen Garden by Renee Shepherd and Fran Raboff, a helpful book for preparing meals based on fresh garden produce. The recipes are simple but very creative. Tomato Season Meal Plan. Sunday, grilled chicken with tomato salad and corn on the cob. Monday, homemade gazpacho with fresh bread and cream cheese. Tuesday, roasted tomato eggplant ratatouille with rice or bread and grated parmesan. Wednesday, grilled fish or lamb served with crusty bread, chutney, and green bean pate. Thursday, Asian vegetable stir fry with soba noodles or rice and sweet and sour sauce. Friday, pizza with sliced tomatoes, fresh basil, mozzarella, and a drizzle of olive oil. Saturday, pasta with fresh homemade tomato sauce and meatballs.
Chapter 14. You Can't Run Away on Harvest Day. September. The Saturday of Labor Day weekend dawned with a sweet, translucent bite, like a golden, delicious apple. I always seem to harbor a childlike hope through the berry-stained months of June and July that summer will be for keeps. But then a day comes in early fall to remind me why it should end after all. In September, the quality of daylight shifts toward flirtation. The green berries on the spice bush shrubs along our lane begin to blink red, first one and then another, like faltering but resolute holiday lights. The woods fill with the restless singing of migrant birds warming up to the proposition of flying south. The cool air makes us restless, too. Jeans and sweater weather, perfect for a hike. Stephen and I rose early that morning, looked out the window, looked at each other, and started in on the time-honored marital grumble. Was this your idea? We weren't going on a hike today, nor would we have the post-summer Saturday luxury of sitting on the porch with a cup of coffee and watching the farm wake up. On the docket, instead, was a hard day of work we could not postpone. The previous morning, we'd sequestered half a dozen roosters and as many tom turkeys in a room of the barn we call Death Row. We hold poultry there, clean and comfortable, with water, but no food, for a 24-hour fast prior to harvest. It makes the processing cleaner and seems to calm the animals also. I could tell you, it gives them time to get their emotional affairs in order, if that helps. But they have limited emotional affairs and no idea what's coming. We had a lot more of both. Our plan for this gorgeous day was the removal of some of our animals from the world of the living into the realm of food. At 5 months of age, our roosters had put on a good harvest weight and had lately opened rounds of cockfighting, venting their rising hormonal angst against any moving target, including us. When a rooster flies up at you with his spurs, he leaves marks. Lily now had to arm herself with a length of pipe in order to gather the eggs. Our barnyard wasn't big enough for this much machismo. We would certainly take no pleasure in the chore, but it was high time for the testosterone reduction program. We sighed at the lovely weather and pulled out our old bloody sneakers for harvest day. There was probably a time when I thought it euphemistic to speak of harvesting animals. Now I don't. We calculate months to harvest when planning for the right time to start poultry. We invite friends to harvest parties, whether we'll be gleaning vegetable or animal. A harvest implies planning, respect, and effort. With animals, both the planning and physical effort are often greater, and respect for the enterprise is substantially more complex. It's a lot less fun than spending an autumn day picking apples off trees, but it's a similar operation on principle and the same word. Killing is a culturally loaded term, for most of us inextricably tied up with some version of a command that begins, "Thou shalt not." Every faith has it. And for all but perhaps the Jainists of India, that command is absolutely conditional. We know it does not refer to mosquitoes. Who among us has never killed living creatures on purpose? When a child is sick with an infection, we rush for the medicine spoon, committing an eager and purposeful streptococcus massacre. We sprinkle boric acid or grab a spray can to rid our kitchens of cockroaches. What we mean by killing is to take a life cruelly, as in murder, or else more accidentally, as in, whoops, looks like I killed my African violet. Though the results are incomparable, what these different killings have in common is needless waste and some presumed measure of regret. Most of us, if we know even a little about where our food comes from, understand that every bite put into our mouths since infancy, barring the odd rock or marble, was formerly alive. The blunt biological truth is that we animals can only remain alive by eating other life. Plants are inherently more blameless, having been born with the talent of whipping up their own food peacefully and without noise, out of sunshine, water, and the odd mineral ingredient sucked up through their toes. Strangely enough, it's the animals to which we've assigned some rights, while the saintly plants we maim and behead with moral impunity. Who thinks to beg forgiveness while mowing the lawn? The moral rules of destroying our fellow biota get even more tangled the deeper we go. If we draw the okay to kill line between animal and plant, and thus exclude meat, fowl, and fish from our diet on moral grounds, we still must live with the fact that every sack of flour and every soybean-based block of tofu came from a field where countless winged and furry lives were extinguished in the plowing, cultivating, and harvest. An estimated 67 million birds die each year from pesticide exposure on U.S. farms. Butterflies, too, are universally killed on contact in larval form by the genetically modified pollen contained in most U.S. corn. Foxes, rabbits, and bobolinks are starved out of their homes or dismembered by the sickle mower. Insects are controlled, even by organic pesticides. Earthworms are cut in half by the plow. Contrary to lore, they won't grow into two. Both halves die. To believe we can live without taking life is delusional. Humans may only cultivate nonviolence in our diets by degree. I've heard a Buddhist monk suggest the number of food-caused deaths is minimized in steak dinners, which share one death over many meals, whereas the equation is reversed for a bowl of clams. Others of us have lost heart for eating any steak dinner that's been shoved through the assembly line of feedlot life, however broadly we might share that responsibility. I take my gospel from Wendell Berry, who writes in What Are People For? I dislike the thought that some animal has been made miserable in order to feed me. If I am going to eat meat, I want it to be from an animal that has lived a pleasant, uncrowded life outdoors, on bountiful pasture, with good water nearby and trees for shade. And I am getting almost as fussy about food plants. I find myself fundamentally allied with the vegetarian position in every way except one. However selectively, I eat meat. I'm unimpressed by arguments that condemn animal harvest while ignoring wholesale the animal killing that underwrites vegetal foods. Uncountable deaths by pesticide and habitat removal. The beetles and bunnies that die collaterally for our bread and veggie burgers are lives plumb wasted. Animal harvest is at least not gratuitous, as part of a plan involving labor and recompense. We raise these creatures for a reason. Such premeditation may be presumed unkind, but without it, our gentle domestic beasts, in their picturesque shapes, colors, and finely tuned purposes, would never have had the distinction of existing. To envision a vegan version of civilization, start by erasing from all time the three little pigs, the boy who cried wolf, Charlotte's Web, the golden calf, Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Next, erase civilization, brought to you by the people who learned to domesticate animals. Finally, rewrite our evolutionary history, since Homo sapiens became the species we are by means of regular binges of carnivory. Most confounding of all in the vegan revision are the chapters addressing the future. If farm animals have civil rights, what aspect of their bondage to humans shall they overcome? Most wouldn't last 2 days without it. Recently, while I was cooking eggs, my kid sat at the kitchen table entertaining me with readings from a magazine profile of a famous, rather young vegan movie star. Her dream was to create a safe haven ranch where the cows and chickens could live free, happy lives and die natural deaths. Wait till those cows start bawling to be milked, I warned. Having nursed and weaned my own young, I can tell you there is no pain to compare with an overfilled udder. We wondered what the starlet might do for those bursting jerseys, not to mention the eggs the chickens would keep dropping everywhere. What a life's work for that poor gal, traipsing about the farm in her strappy heels, weaving among the cow flops, bending gracefully to pick up eggs and stick them in an incubator where they would maddeningly hatch and grow up bent on laying more eggs. It's dirty work trying to save an endless chain of uneaten lives. Realistically, my kids observed, she'd hire somebody. Forgive us. We know she meant well, and as fantasies of the super-rich go, it's more inspired than most. It's just the high-mindedness that rankles. When moral superiority combines with billowing ignorance, they fill up a hot-air balloon that's awfully hard not to poke. The farm liberation fantasy simply reflects a modern cultural confusion about farm animals. They're human property, not just legally, but biologically. Over the millennia of our clever history, we created from wild progenitors whole new classes of beasts whose sole purpose was to feed us. If turned loose in the wild, they would haplessly starve, succumb to predation, and destroy the habitats and lives of most or all natural things. If housed at the public expense, they would pose a more immense civic burden than our public schools and prisons combined. No thoughtful person really wants those things to happen. But living at a remove from the actual workings of a farm, most humans no longer learn appropriate modes of thinking about animal harvest. Knowing that our family raises meat animals, many friends have told us, not judgmentally, just confessionally, I don't think I could kill an animal myself. I find myself explaining, it's not what you think. It's nothing like putting down your dog. Most non-farmers are intimate with animal life in only three categories. People, pets, which is to say junior people, and wildlife, as seen on nature shows, presumed beautiful and rare. Purposefully beheading any of the above is unthinkable for obvious reasons. No other categories present themselves at close range for consideration. So I understand why it's hard to think about harvest. A categorical act that includes cutting the heads off living lettuces, extended to crops that blink their beady eyes. On our farm, we don't especially enjoy processing our animals, but we do value it as an important ritual for ourselves and any friends adventurous enough to come and help, because of what we learn from it. We reconnect with the purpose for which these animals were bred. We dispense with all delusions about who put the live in livestock and who must take it away. A friend from whom we buy pasture-grazed lamb and poultry has concurred with us on this point. Kirsty Zanka grew up in the UK and observes that American attitudes toward life and death probably add to the misgivings. "People in this country do everything to cheat death, it seems," she told me. "Instead of being happy with each moment, they worry so much about what comes next. I think this gets transposed to animals, the preoccupation with taking a life. My animals have all had a good life, with death as its natural end. It's not without thought and gratitude that I slaughter my animals. It is a hard thing to do. It's taken me time to be able to eat my own lambs that I had played with. But I always think of Khalil Gibran's words. When you kill a beast, say to him in your heart, 'By the same power that slays you, I too am slain, and I too shall be consumed. For the law that delivers you into my hand shall deliver me into a mightier hand. Your blood and my blood is naught but the sap that feeds the tree of heaven.'" Kirsty works with a local environmental organization and frequently hosts its out-of-town volunteers who camp at her farm while working in the area. Many of these activists had not eaten meat for many years before arriving on the Zanka's meat farm, a formula not for disaster, she notes, but for education. She told me, "If one gets to know the mantras of the farm owners, it can change one's viewpoint. I would venture to say that 75% of the vegans and vegetarians who stayed at least a week here began to eat our meat or animal products simply because they see what I am doing as right for the animals, for the environment, for humans." I respect every diner who makes morally motivated choices about consumption. And I stand with nonviolence as one of those extremist moms who doesn't let kids at her house pretend to shoot each other ever or make any game out of human murder. But I've come to different conclusions about livestock. The vevangelical pamphlets showing jam-packed chickens and sick downer cows usually declare as their first principle that all meat is factory farmed. That is false, and an affront to those of us who work to raise animals humanely or who support such practices with our buying power. I don't want to cause any creature misery, so I won't knowingly eat anything that has stood belly deep in its own poop wishing it was dead until, bam, one day it was. In restaurants, I go for the fish or the vegetarian option. But meat, poultry, and eggs from animals raised on open pasture are the traditional winter fare of my grandparents, and they serve us well here in the months when it would cost a lot of fossil fuels to keep us in tofu. Should I overlook the suffering of victims of hurricanes, famines, and wars brought on this world by profligate fuel consumption? Bananas that cost a rainforest, refrigerator-trucked soy milk, and pre-washed spinach shipped 2,000 miles in plastic containers do not seem cruelty-free in this context. 100 different paths may lighten the world's load of suffering. Giving up meat is one path. Giving up bananas is another. The more we know about our food system, the more we are called into complex choices. It seems facile to declare one single forbidden fruit when humans live under so many different kinds of trees. To breed fewer meat animals in the future is possible. Phasing out those types destined for confinement lots is a plan I'm assisting myself by raising heirloom breeds. Most humans could well consume more vegetable foods and less meat. But globally speaking, the vegetarian option is a luxury. The oft-cited energetic argument for vegetarianism, that it takes 10 times as much land to make a pound of meat than a pound of grain, only applies to the kind of land where rain falls abundantly on rich topsoil. Many of the world's poor live in marginal lands that can't support plant-based agriculture. Those not blessed with the fruited plain and amber waves of grain must make do with woody tree pods, tough-leaved shrubs, or sparse grasses. Camels, reindeer, sheep, goats, cattle, and other ruminants are uniquely adapted to transform all those types of indigestible cellulose into edible milk and meat. The fringes of desert, tundra, and marginal grasslands on every continent, coastal Peru, the southwestern United States, the Kalahari, the Gobi, the Australian outback, northern Scandinavia, are all inhabited by herders. The Navajo, Mongols, Laps, Maasai, and countless other resourceful tribes would starve without their animals. Domestic herds can also carry problems into these habitats. Overgrazing has damaged plenty of the world's landscapes, as has clearing rainforests to make way for cattle ranches. But well-managed grazing can actually benefit natural habitats where native grazers exist or formerly existed. Environmental research in North and South American deserts has shown that careful introduction of cattle, sheep, or goats into some grasslands helps return the balance of their native vegetation, especially mesquite trees and their kin, which co-evolved for millennia with large grazing mammals, mastodons, and camels that are now extinct. Mesquite seeds germinate best after passing through the stomach of a ruminant. Then the habitat also needs the return of fire and prairie dog predation on the mesquite seedlings. Granted, it's complicated, but grazers do belong. In northwestern Peru, in the extremely arid, deforested region of Piura, an innovative project is using a four-legged tool for widespread reforestation, goats. This grassless place lost most of its native mesquite forests to human refugees who were pushed out of greener places, settled here, and cut down most of the trees for firewood. Goats can subsist on the seed pods of the remaining mesquites without damaging the thorny trees, and spread the seeds, depositing them across the land inside neat fertilizer pellets. The goats also provide their keepers with meat and milk in a place where rainfall is so scarce, zero in some years, it's impossible to subsist on vegetable crops. The herds forage freely when mesquite beans are in season and live the rest of the year on pods stored in cement block granaries. These low-maintenance animals also reproduce themselves free of charge, so the project broadens its reforesting and hunger relief capacities throughout the region year by year. We cranky environmentalists tend to nurture a hunch that humans and our food systems are always dangerous to the earth. But when I visited Piura to study the Mesquite Goat Project, I could not name any measure by which the project was anything but successful. The before scenario involved malnourished families in a desiccated brown landscape. Within a few years after receiving goats, the families still lived in simple mud and lath homes, but their villages were shaded by green oases of fast-growing native vegetation. They milked the goats, made cheese, burned mesquite pods for cooking fuel, and looked forward to eating meat several times each month. Small irrigated gardens of beans and leafy greens provided supplementary nutrition, but in this climate, it's animal products that can offer the prospect of ending malnutrition. Each goat-owning family makes an agreement with the donor organizations, Heifer International and the local group Acpiodesa, to give the first female offspring to another family, thus moving their own status from poor to benefactor, a powerfully important distinction in terms of local decision-making and further stewardship of the land. For the same money, a shipment of donated wheat, rice, or corn would only have maintained the region's widespread poverty through another few months and deepened its environmental crisis. Between vegetable or animal solutions to that region's problems, my vote goes to the goats. The mountainous part of the United States where I live, though neither destitute nor desiccated, has its own challenges. The farms here are small and steep. Using diesel tractors to turn the earth every spring, where that's even possible, sends our topsoil downhill into the creeks with every rain, creating many problems at once. One of the region's best options for feeding ourselves and our city neighbors may be pasture-based hoofstock and poultry. Cattle, goats, sheep, turkeys, and chickens all have their own efficient ways of turning steep, grass-covered hillsides into food while fertilizing the land discreetly with their manure. They do it without drinking a drop of gasoline. Managed grazing is healthier for most landscapes, in fact, than annual tilling and planting, and far more fuel efficient. Grass is a solar-powered, infinitely renewable resource. As consumers discover the health benefits of grass-based meat, more farmers may stop plowing land and let animals go to work on it instead. A crucial part of this enterprise involves recovering the heritage cattle, poultry, and other livestock that can fatten on pasture grass. It's news to most people that chicken, turkeys, and pigs can eat foliage at all, since we're used to seeing them captive and fed. Even cattle are doing less and less grass eating since 20th century breeding programs gave us animals that tolerate, barely, a grain-based diet for weight gain during their final 8 months in confinement. For decades, the public has demanded no meat animals but these. More lately, though, conditions inside confined feeding operations have been exposed by voices as diverse as talk show host Oprah Winfrey and Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser. In an essay titled Food with a Face, journalist Michael Pollan wrote, "More than any other institution, the American industrial animal farm offers a nightmarish glimpse of what capitalism can look like in the absence of moral or regulatory constraint. Here in these places, life itself is redefined as protein production, and with it, suffering. That venerable word becomes stress, an economic problem in search of a cost-effective solution. The industrialization and dehumanization of American animal farming is a relatively new, evitable, and local phenomenon. No other country raises and slaughters its food animals quite as intensively or as brutally as we do." End quote. U.S. consumers may take our pick of reasons to be wary of the resulting product: growth hormones, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, unhealthy cholesterol composition, deadly E. coli strains, fuel consumption, concentration of manure into toxic waste lagoons, and the turpitude of keeping confined creatures at the limits of their physiological and psychological endurance. It's that last one that finally ended it for me. Yes, I am a person who raises some animals for the purpose of whacking them into cuts of meat to feed my family. But this work has made me more sympathetic, not less, toward the poor wretches that have to live shoulder to shoulder with their brethren waiting for the next meal of stomach-corroding porridge. In 97, when our family gave up meat from CAFOs, that choice was synonymous with becoming a vegetarian. No real alternatives existed. Now they do. Pasture-based chicken and turkey are available in Whole Food stores and many mainstream supermarkets. Farmers' markets are a likely source for free-range eggs, poultry, beef, lamb, and pork. Farmers who raise animals on pasture have to charge more, of course, than factories that cut every corner on animal soundness. Some consumers will feel they have to buy the cheaper product. Others will eat meat less often and pay the higher price. As demand rises and more farmers can opt out of the industrial system, the cost structure will shift. After many meatless years, it felt strange to us to break the taboo, but over time, our family has come back to carnivory. I like listening to a roasting bird in the oven on a Sunday afternoon, following Julia Child's advice to, and this is a quote, regulate the chicken so it makes quiet cooking noises as its schmaltzy aroma fills my house. When a friend began raising beef cattle entirely on pasture, rather than sending them to a CAFO as six-month-olds, as most cattle farmers do, we were born again to the idea of hamburger. We can go visit his animals if we need to be reassured of the merciful cowness of their lives. As meat farmers ourselves, we are learning as we go, raising heritage breeds, the thrifty antiques that know how to stand in the sunshine, gaze upon a meadow, and munch, even mate without help. We're grateful these old breeds weren't consigned to extinction during the past century, though it nearly did happen. Were it not for these animals that can thrive outdoors and the healthy farms that maintain them, I would have stuck with tofu burgers indefinitely. That wasn't a bad life, but we're also enjoying this one.
Really, We're Not Mad, by Stephen Hoppe. Cows must have some friends in high places. If a shipment of ground beef somehow gets contaminated with pathogens, our federal government does not have the authority to recall the beef, only to request that the company issue a recall. When the voluntary recall is initiated, the federal government does not release information on where the contaminated beef is being sold, considering that information proprietary. Apparently, it is more important to protect the cows than the people eating them. Now I need to be careful where I go next, because, for their own protection, there are laws in 13 states that make it illegal to say anything bad about cows. One serious disease related to our friends, the cows, has emerged in the last 20 years. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, or so-called mad cow disease. Mad cow and its human variant, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, are invariably fatal for both cows and humans. Unfortunately, tracking mad cow is complicated by the fact that it frequently incubates for years in the victim. The disease became infamous during the 1980s outbreak in England, where more than 150 humans died from eating BSE beef, and thousands of cattle were destroyed. A tiny malformed protein called a prion is the BSE culprit. The prions cause other proteins in the victim to rearrange into their unusual shape and destroy tissue. Prions confine their activities to the nervous system, where they cause death. How do cows contract prions? Apparently from eating other cows. What? Yes, dead cow meat gets mixed into their feed, imposing cannibalism onto their lifestyle. It's a way to get a little more mileage from the byproducts of the slaughterhouse. An appropriate response would be to stop this, which the British did. They also began testing 100% of cows over 2 years old at slaughter for BSE and removing all downer cows, or cows unable to walk on their own, from the food supply. As a result, the United Kingdom virtually eradicated BSE in 2 years. Reasonably enough, Japan implemented the same policies. In the United States, the response has been somewhat different. United States policies restrict feeding cow tissue directly to other cows, but still allow cows to be fed to other animals, like chickens, and the waste from the chickens to be fed back to the cows. Since prions aren't destroyed by extreme heat or any known drug, they readily survive this food chain loop-de-loop. Cow blood, yum, may also be dinner for other cows and calves, and restaurant plate wastes can also be served. After the first detected case of U.S. mad cow disease, 52 countries banned U.S. beef. The USDA then required 2% of all the downer cows to be tested and 1% of all cows that were slaughtered. After that, the number of downer cows reported in the United States decreased by 20%. Did I mention it was voluntary reporting? And only 2 more cases of BSE were detected. In May 2006, the USDA decided that the threat was so low that only 0.1% of all slaughtered cows needed to be tested. Gene Halloran, the Food Policy Initiatives Director at the Consumers Union, responded, "It approaches a policy of don't look, don't find." How can consumers respond to this? Can we seek out beef tested as BSE-free by the meat packers? No. One company tried to test all its beef, but the USDA declared that illegal, possibly to protect any BSE cows from embarrassment. Would I suggest a beef boycott? Heavens no. Cows are our friends. Plus, I believe that would be illegal. But it might be worth remembering this. Not a single case of BSE anywhere has ever turned up in cattle that were raised and finished on pasture grass or organic feed. As for the other 99% of beef in the United States, my recommendation would be to consider the words of Gary Weber, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association head of regulatory affairs. "The consumers we've done focus groups with are comfortable that this is a very rare disease." For more information, visit organicconsumers.org/madcow.html.
Believing in the righteousness of a piece of work, alas, is not what gets it done. On harvest day, we pulled on our stained shoes, sharpened our knives, lit a fire under the big kettle, and set ourselves to the whole show, mud, blood, and lots of little feathers. There are some things about a chicken harvest that are irrepressibly funny, and one of them is the feathers, in your hair, on the backs of your hands, dangling behind your left shoe the way toilet paper does in slapstick movies. Feathery little white tags end up stuck all over the chopping block and the butchering table like post-it notes from the chicken hereafter. Sometimes we get through the awful parts on the strength of black comedy, joking about the feathers or our barn's death row and the dead roosters walking. But today was not one of those times. Some friends had come over to help us, including a family that had recently lost their teenage son in a drowning accident. Their surviving younger children, Abby and Eli, were among Lily's closest friends. The kids were understandably solemn, and the adults measured all our words under the immense weight of grief as we set to work. Lily and Abby went to get the first rooster from the barn, while I laid out the knives and spread plastic sheets over our butchering table on the back patio. The guys stoked a fire under our 50-gallon kettle, an antique brass instrument Stephen and I scored at a farm auction. The girls returned carrying rooster number one upside down by the legs. Inversion has the immediate effect of lulling a chicken to sleep, or something near to it. What comes next is quick and final. We set the rooster gently across our big chopping block, a legendary fixture of our backyard whose bloodstains hold visiting children in thrall. And down comes the axe. All sensation ends with that quick stroke. He must then be held by the legs over a large plastic bucket until all the blood has run out. Farmers who regularly process poultry have more equipment, including banks of killing cones or inverted funnels that contain the birds while the processor pierces each neck with a sharp knife, cutting 2 major arteries and ending brain function. We're not pros, so we have a more rudimentary setup. By lulling and swiftly decapitating my animal, I can make sure my relatively unpracticed handling won't draw out the procedure or cause pain. What you've heard is true. The rooster will flap his wings hard during this part. If you drop him, he'll thrash right across the yard, unpleasantly spewing blood all around. Though the body doesn't run, it's nothing that well coordinated. His newly detached head silently opens and closes its mouth down in the bottom of the gut bucket, a world apart from the ruckus. The cause of all these actions is an explosion of massively firing neurons without a brain to supervise them. Most people who claim to be running around like a chicken with its head cut off really are not even close. The nearest thing might be the final convulsive seconds of an all-star wrestling match. For Rooster Number One, it was over, and into the big kettle for a quick scald. After a one-minute immersion in 145-degree water, the muscle tissue releases the feathers so they're easier to pluck. Easier is relative. Every last feather still has to be pulled, carefully enough to avoid tearing the skin. The downy breast feathers come out by handfuls, while the long wing and tail feathers sometimes must be removed individually with pliers. If we were pros, we would have an electric scalder and automatic plucker, a fascinating bucket full of rotating rubber fingers that does the job in no time flat. For future harvests, we might borrow a friend's equipment, but for today, we had a pulley on a tree limb so we could hoist the scalded carcass to shoulder level, suspending it there from a rope so several of us could pluck at once. Lily, Abby, and Eli pulled neck and breast feathers, making necessary observations such as, "Gag, look where his head came off," and, "Wonder which one of these tube thingies was his windpipe." Most kids need only about 90 seconds to get from "ew, gross" to solid science. A few weeks later, Abby would give an award-winning, fully illustrated 4-H presentation entitled, "You Can't Run Away on Harvest Day." Laura and Becky and I answered the kids' questions and also talked about mom things while working on back and wing feathers. Our husbands were on to the next beheading. Laura and I compared notes on our teenage daughters, relatively new drivers on the narrow country roads between their jobs, friends, and home, and the worries that come with that territory. I was painfully conscious of Becky's quiet, her ache for a teenage son who never even got to acquire a driver's license. The accident that killed Larry could not have been avoided through any amount of worry. We all cultivate illusions of safety that could fall away in the knife edge of 1 second. I wondered how we would get through this afternoon, how she would get through months and years